History is made in such a way that the final result always arises from conflicts between many individual wills, of which each in turn has been made what it is by a host of particular conditions of life. Thus, there are innumerable intersecting forces, an infinite series of parallelograms of forces, which give rise to one resultant, the historical event. Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Jason.
And we have with us today, Michael. Say hi, Michael.
Hey.
Michael is a sociology instructor and a labor activist somewhere in the United States of America. It's a place where it's cold, but that's all you get to know. So today we are talking about great man theory and the role of the individual in history. Jason and I have been having conversations recently about how the American left seems to really need a great figure in order to feel as though something is happening, or to feel as though there is hope. What do Marxists say about the role of the individual in history? Recently, Jason and I were having a conversation about Bernie Sanders. Criticisms of Bernie Sanders being all about how Bernie Sanders is not a real socialist, Bernie Sanders is affiliated to the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders is has done this, he's voted like that, whatever. And those are the reasons why Bernie Sanders shouldn't be supported. And then at the same time, these other people are saying, no, what we really need is, you know, a real socialist figure, Hugo Chavez or Fidel Castro or, you know, Trotsky or whoever. And then at the same time, you've got the Bernie people that support it, that support Bernie, saying things like, no, Bernie has dedicated this much of his life, you know, fighting for the working class. He is a socialist, and he does represent the things that he's been saying. And he hasn't strayed away from where he was when he was supporting the Sandinistas and praising Cuba. And to me, I'm thinking that's all irrelevant. None of this shit matters. What matters is that Sanders represented a potentiality. He represented a way to heighten contradictions, to drive a wedge into a crack and maybe open up an opening for like working class movement to insert itself into the conversation.
Yeah, and I also think that like a lot of what passes for like left historiography boils down to essentially like conflicts between individuals and a lot of like alternative history theorizing about what if this individual had won out against that one, or even that people sort of think of themselves as like the representatives of a tendency of an individual person's thought. So that like, despite the fact that, you know, we like to think of the politics and philosophy of Marxism as being about history, that we do tend to reduce our scope and our field of vision to individuals. But I think that the flip side of that, which is super uninteresting, is a very rigid determinism which says individuals don't matter at all, and that actually there's just blind forces of history at work, and that people just sort of exist within parameters not of their choosing, and then, you know, just sort of act out a script that was basically written for them by history, and that is presented as a Marxism. And basically, yeah, but neither of these seem satisfactory, so we thought, like, let's talk about it in a more holistic way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the setup with thinking about the Sanders question and the role of the individual for the left is interesting. I mean, now looking at it, his campaign wasn't that long ago. It feels as though it was a million years ago because so much has happened since. The Sanders story has kind of been like, it's a bit like the great man who wasn't. He did serve this role. He like served the role as the individual who could in many ways sort of like, cohere a broad left-wing formation in the United States. Ultimately though, he didn't. His ultimate incapacity to do that is, you know, it's not a result of individual features or individual characteristics on his part, but I think a result of the constraints that he was under as a politician running for office in the United States, right? And he had to contend with electoral institutions that are designed in particular ways. He had to contend with, like, certain kinds of peculiarities about American elections in particular, and those weren't overcome. He had to contend even with the particular structure of primaries, for instance, which, mm-hmm. you know, relatively speaking, weakens the more enthusiastic lefty elements that comprise the Sanders campaign compared to, you know, sort of establishment Democrats, right? He was embedded in these kinds of electoral structures that whatever he could bring to the table as an individual, he couldn't overcome. And here we are. We're left with a postmortem.
Right. Well, and he also had to be the representative of a not exceptionally mature, and I don't mean that like in an insulting way, like, look at all these immature people, but I mean
a totally unorganized left.
Right, right, yeah. Exactly. Lacking maturity in the sense of lacking institutional weight, lacking in organizational cohesion, lacking historical memory, lacking experience. Yeah, I mean, like the thread that ties generations, you know, from one to the next is, it's pretty well documented. It's been, broken, so that this part of the hope of the Sanders moment is that, you know, because of this particular individual figure, that I think a lot of us, whether people were conscious of it or not, were looking to sort of leapfrog development, you know, and it's understandable, especially if you do have a long view of history and you look back at the 20th century and you do see you see in the historical record a reason to not be completely dismissive of a certain kind of thinking that would allow you to do that.
And I think that when, you know, someone like me or you, Jason, looking at the Sanders moment as for our entire adult lives, having been part of some sort of revolutionary tendency that eschewed electoralism completely, and coming to the 2016 and the most recent set of primaries and thinking, well, you know, I mean, I guess using this moment as a way to bring working class politics into the mainstream in some fashion seems like the only thing to do. It would be insane not to. And Sanders was a representative of the moment more so than anything else. And of course he was a representative of the moment by virtue of the fact that he had spent his entire career having some sort of loose connection to left-wing politics, left-wing populist politics, and some nominal form of socialism. So yeah, that put him in that position. But to me, he really represented that moment. And it really didn't matter to me whether or not he was a true socialist or not, whether or not he was going to make people think that socialism was something else. That's something I heard a lot. It's like, Sanders is going to make everybody think that socialism is a thing that it's not. And I was just like, okay, well, you know, well, let's talk to him about it after Sanders blows open a gigantic hole in the wall that allows us to get through a little bit, you know? That was Sanders' worth to me.
Yeah, I think there are two things about that I think are of basically equal importance to me. The first one is I've been recently sort of thinking through the idea of like a vulgar Marxism as something that we have historically thought of as that's bad, like an overpopularization to the point of dumbing down really sometimes complicated things. But like, we should be so lucky as for there to be a popular, broad, vulgar Marxism in this country right now, right? Like our role as people who, let's say, have a sense of things, but having no interests apart from the labor movement as a whole, should be to in a generation to be looked back on as vulgar Marxists. Like our thought should be woefully inadequate in a generation. So popularizing, you know, even a bad, a somewhat undeveloped vision of socialism seems like a very worthy thing to do. And I think that did happen over the course of the last 4 years. So I think that's what has transpired, and we've seen that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's you're going to be hard pressed to find a mass politics of any sort that isn't like a vulgarization of some sort of other politics, right? You know, the like highly intellectualized, like sophisticated Marxism is just not going to be the thing that grips the masses, in the same way that nothing has ever gripped the masses in a highly like intellectualized and sophisticated form of presentation. Politics is, you know, the mass politics work because they're they mobilize and they motivate, and the vulgar politics can do the trick there. I mean, the really like, you know, people criticize in retrospect for all kinds of like theoretically and so on, totally sound reasons, the sort of orthodox Marxism of like the Second International and stuff, with its sort of like stagist conception and like an overblown notion of the inevitability of socialism. But, and this comes up in the readings too, by the way, but the notion of that inevitability, that, mm-hmm. that particular vulgarity in the masses Marxism was what gave it so much strength. And is what enabled people to act in ways that they otherwise perhaps would not have if they did not believe in the inevitability of their goals mm-hmm. and their own role in the production of that inevitable result. Well, it's vulgar Marxism, but like, you know, who the fuck cares?
Right. I mean, that's what Plekhanov calls like the sort of that's the what does he say? It's the freedom that grows out of necessity.
That's right. Right.
It's like that. Once you recognize yourself or you develop a conception of yourself as being an embodiment of either like the will of history or the will of God or whatever it may be, some transcendental force that is greater than the individual, then suddenly you become incredibly free to act in whatever way is deemed necessary to you. And that's how you can have a Robespierre who, isolated from the moment, would, if he was actually to act the way he tried to act, would be seen as a deranged person rather than one of the most influential heads of state and human beings in all of history, at least in recorded history. So that actually gets me to the second thing, because, you know, I said that I have two thoughts on this. The second one is about Hugo Chavez. And I think sometimes we forget that Chavez starts his political career as like a fairly standard liberal politician. And and it's
he starts his political career as a general.
Well, yeah, he tries to mount a coup, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But then when he runs and he wins an election, he wins as a very vague reformer type that doesn't have a clear conception of politics at all. It's like an anti-corruption campaign, essentially. And it's the process of being in power and coming up against the institutional obstacles and then being taken from power in a coup and then brought back to power by the masses of working people in Venezuela that teaches Chavez a socialism, which then is transmitted back in a popular way to the process between, you know, the masses kind of coming to the defense of the Republic and the Republic being restored. It gives Chavez a socialism, a language of socialism that then becomes the popular politics of the country. And 7 million people join a new party called the United Socialist Party of Venezuela and all the rest of it. So it's a funny thing to think about, like how that plays out, because it's not, it is not the case that Hugo Chavez ever really becomes like a super sophisticated political thinker. And he certainly doesn't start as one. And yet the whole Bolivarian socialist process or whatever is personified by this person, which is, I think, the reason why it makes sense to me in the first instance for people to kind of latch on to these figures. Like, as I remember the slogan, it was like, Por Chavez, vota PSUV, which is like, if you like the president, you should vote socialist. And that was the way in which the original connection to socialist politics is made mass in the first place.
Yeah, one's reminded of, in a different mode, slogan of the labor movement in the 1930s, that the president wants you to join a union.
That's exactly right. I don't exactly know what this whole union thing's all about, but I like this guy. He seems to have my interests at heart. I trust him, right? So I'm gonna go look into it. And in a nutshell, that is the role of the individual in history, right? That there are these like punctuated moments where a person personifies all of the possibilities. Of course, the danger then is you just look at the continuation of the process in Venezuela and you see how much it actually matters that that one person is there or not.
Right. So these individuals insert themselves into the, you know, the process of history because the process of history has made these people possible. And these people seize on moments to articulate ideas that are just waiting to come forward. So there is a role for an individual in history, and it's that. It's to realize ideas that are happening.
Right. Like, I think what's really interesting about how to dive deeper into this is Trotsky's contention that the 1917 revolution could have happened without him, but could not have happened without Lenin. And that seems like such an absurd claim when you think about the collapse of the army, the whole situation in the war, unrest in the streets and everything else. But then you look at the way in which the rest of the leadership of the Bolshevik Party like is not for a seizure of power. It actually takes this one person's iron will to convince the immediate people around him to like propagate the necessity of seizing power that makes the revolution possible, even if history called for it, even if it was called forth by the processes that are more blind and that are less immediately tangible. There are certain moments where like a person's hand is on a lever and they can either push it forward or pull it backward. And it's really interesting to consider, like, you know, because, you know, to connect back to the first thing we were talking about, you know, Michael, you referred to Sanders as the great man who wasn't. And that's the difference, right? Is it, in some ways, it's just a matter of like we can only speculate what sort of historical processes continue to play out in this country had that situation gone differently. But you can see where an individual plays a decisive role that moves things that now seem necessary and historically inevitable, but actually come down to a couple of personal individual decisions.
I was thinking about Trump. I was thinking about Donald Trump and the, you know, sort of what he represents in light of these kinds of great men ideas. And there's something so like odd about Trump and about like this moment where it's like he has served this kind of role where he can kind of be the sort of focal point and articulator of politics that's of course much broader than him and that has a pedigree longer than his administration, and you know he rode that social force to office, but also can speak on its behalf and can like serve as a symbol for it that tends to unite it and so on, but as an individual it's almost empty, right? There's just almost no, it's like the individual there has been made great entirely by the social forces around him and by not a shred of his own like personal acumen, of which there's none, or foresight, of which there's none. And you almost have to just like, you almost have to thank God that he wasn't a more like articulate or competent organizer or administrator.
Absolutely. Like if Rosa Luxemburg is like a brilliant mind who, because she's murdered, isn't there to play the Lenin role in Germany, Donald Trump is the exact opposite in exactly every way. He's a utterly empty-headed, vapid, incoherent thinker who, by virtue of never facing any adversity in his life and no danger ever, finds himself in the position of being the personification of the general will, however objectionable that general will actually is, right?
The Trotsky's description of Stalin is kind of comes to mind when talking about Trump, but Stalin at least was a shrewd maneuverer, even if he had no other qualities outside of
that. He also could at least give a speech where you knew what he was saying.
Yeah, yeah. So Trotsky says something like that Stalin was about as great of a man as could be and still remaining utterly mediocre.
Oh, yeah. He was the outstanding mediocrity of history.
The outstanding mediocrity of history. Exactly. So, and so what that allowed was for the bureaucracy to like see itself personified in Stalin and for him to take on the will of the bureaucracy as his will. Mm-hmm. But Trump really just became a figurehead for a movement accidentally, just by being a jackass on the TV.
Well, we have a lot of jackasses, and their general will must be personified.
Exactly. And, you know, and he's kept in place now by the fact that he's the head of the other party of capitalism, capitalism's A-team, which generally at least does a competent job of of carrying out wars of conquest and, you know, slashing social services without causing too much of a fucking uproar. That seems like to be its only real job, is to kind of like at least provide law and order and stability while they're eviscerating, you know, our social welfare system. But Trump seems to be completely incapable of even carrying out the smallest task that's been assigned to him.
Well, the task that's been assigned to him by history, which is to oversee the decline of the American empire. I think he's doing a great job.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Well, so like in reading the Plekhanov essay, I was thinking about how there's this contention that like that historical materialism is determinist, but that determinism mm-hmm. does not imply quietism, right? That like mm-hmm. He has like what he calls a materialist conception of human will. And it does make you wonder, like, if you think about, just to keep going with the Trump discussion, if you can imagine a situation in which, for whatever reason, let's say he was unable to continue in the primaries in 2016, that the whole history of what over the last several years, would they have played out the same? Like, the question, I guess, is that, like, if Donald Trump didn't exist, would it be necessary for history to invent him, which is what people say about people like Napoleon? Because I don't think that that's necessarily true. Like when Carlyle calls Bonaparte history on horseback, I think that, you know, he's of course talking about like Bonaparte as like a very, like a heroic individual's figure, but he's not talking about this as like just anyone could have fulfilled the role. Like there was a crisis in the Republic and somebody would have eventually mounted a coup and bent the nation to his will and like synthesized the autocratic tendencies that had governed France historically and the Republican spirit that were like animating France in the moment. I'm not convinced that just like anybody could step into that role. And if you look at like a lot of great, impactful historical figures, it is often the case that they do not seem to be surrounded by people who could just as easily step into place.
Specifically because I've been reading about this a lot for school recently, is Hitler. There very, very may well have been a reactionary figure that became like the Mussolini of Germany, right? And stepped in and fulfilled a role of smashing the left and barking on war of conquest to regain the territories lost in World War I or whatever. But Hitler's specific brand of scientific anti-Semitism, the strange brew of like Volkish nationalism and anti-Jewish anti-capitalism that resulted in the Holocaust, was something of a contingency that I think came along with Hitler. You don't see a figure like this anywhere within the Nazi party that would have been capable of mobilizing the German people to commit the Holocaust. He was a particularly charismatic figure, and he imposed his views onto this party and made it what it was. So, yeah, there are instances in history where a specific person is able to have an enormous impact. And I think that those people's ability is emphasized in the modern era, especially in the industrialized era, Hitler was able to have this gigantic impact in history because he was at the head of an enormous military and a highly industrialized state. So an autocrat could kill millions of people and totally change the course of history because of that. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't put in that situation by the process of history.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think here, part of the reason I bring up Trump is that it almost seems like a case for emphasizing the sort of like laws of history rather than individuals. He's almost a case for like here, like an individual who has absolutely nothing to contribute to his own like impact is able to just get sort of catapulted by the forces of history, which he himself does not understand, doesn't fucking care about, like has no interest in whatsoever. It's like he's like running a grift, and like somehow became you know, one of the most, you know, he will be regarded in some way or another, I'm sure, as one of the most important American presidents, with a movement that bears his name, and with him as a symbol. And it's like you kind of see this, you almost see the role, you know, the importance of just the structural position, which, you know, I think you were saying, Chris, where it's like the guy, Trump will just like kind of do anything and say anything, and no one can do shit. Like no one can do absolute shit. Like he's just, he'll just sort of like, in a live interview, sort of like vaguely, suggest he's done something in violation of the law or whatever. And the journalist will be like, wait, so what, like, what is that? And he's like, you know, it's under investigation. I don't know. I heard it. I read it on Facebook. And, you know, then it's just dropped. Everybody forgets about it. He goes on carrying, like, there's no way to get to him in a way. It's like the expansion of the American executive, in every, you know, it basically expands with every administration, but like, you know, especially since, 9/11 has kind of created this like protective bubble for whoever the fuck happens to get launched into that seat. And that's provided a kind of potential for the use of the executive office as a platform, as a place to like pitch discourse to the population and so on, that in principle anybody could occupy, I guess, if Trump can occupy it. And so there's this weird, you know, there's this clear, I think, overwhelming influence of structure. He happens to, I don't know, I don't see the charisma, but he's obviously charismatic. I mean, he's just objectively, in terms of the fact that he's become the sort of lightning rod symbol for certain social forces and for a certain political movement. He's, I guess, by definition, charismatic.
I mean, but people paint pictures of him like super ripped with like an American flag and like a machine gun in his hands and like not ironically, you know, like.
Yeah, he's like riding a bear.
Yeah, the way he is conceived by people suggests an enormous amount of charisma.
Well, he's super good at making the libs just absolutely lose their shit. So it may be a sort of like negative charisma where like he pisses people off so bad that people are like, ooh, that's our guy. But that's, we were sort of talking about this in our Patreon roundtable where we talked about systems and the possibility of like in the screwball comedies of a person that just keeps failing upward.
Mm-hmm.
And until they become the CEO of the company, I think the Hudsucker proxy was like was used as an example. And Trump is a perfect, just like, you know, case A, why structuralism is an accurate way to explain the world, you know, because he really just accidentally fails his way into the presidency and forces totally beyond his control. And of no planning on his own. In fact, I think it's pretty well established that he never expected to win.
Yeah. He seemed pretty upset about it at the time, too.
Yeah, he did. But yeah, I mean, it's a perfect example of that. Yeah. And I think that, like you mentioned, it's like the presidency now is probably the most powerful that it ever has been. And he's just the perfect figurehead for the decline of the American Empire, right? It's just like the system that put him into place is now allowing him to just ride us into the ground.
Right. And so I think, like, referring back to the Plekhanov essay, because that's my favorite of them, like, for the subjectivist view of history, Donald Trump is ruining the American state by virtue of him being there. And that
the Democrat view.
Right. If you could put a different person in, including, like, if you could put a Sanders in, then that would make the American state good, as opposed to making it bad, as it is being made currently bad by Donald Trump. And then for the fatalist view of history, there's no human agency, and whether you had a Trump or a Sanders, in either case, economic laws being what they are, mean a global slowdown, a global decline in the rate of profit, a shift in the locus of new economic might from the United States to China and so on, that, like, no matter what happens, it's the decline's the same. And I think the way that I guess I would like to argue that we should look at things is a question of, like, what is the nature of the decline? And that's where the subjective factor comes in. So like, you could have a decline of the empire, like they had in the United Kingdom, where you could kick out Churchill and you get Attlee, and as a result of the declining empire, you get, the NHS, right? And that's the Sanders view. Like, yes, there are much bigger factors at work than who's the president. The question is considering the circumstances not of their choosing, how will these people make history? And what we got was somebody who maybe was, put in place by history to manage the decline of the empire, but because of their individual subjective agency, the way that decline will be managed is horrifying.
Hello, just wanted to remind everyone of a few things. First of all, we have a Patreon. If you like us enough to give us $2 a month, you can join our Patreon and receive access to our irregularly posted content. We only have one tier, and that tier provides access to our Discord server, which includes discussion about all sorts of stuff which may or may not be relevant to the podcast. We're also going to be doing reading groups and patron roundtables, which will be group discussions on topics decided in the Discord and recorded as special patron-only episodes. In addition to that, we've got our regular patron-only episodes that are posted whenever we come up with a topic or find an article that we think is super interesting and actually have time to talk about it. We have all kinds of ideas for other content and are always looking for more. If any of that interests you, become a patron and join it. I would also like to remind everyone that we are part of the Lost Horizons Network, which is a dialectical pessimist podcasting network, which includes Red Library, From 78, The Regrettable Century, and our supergroup podcast, Well, Here We Are Still, After All, which includes members of all three podcasts. Make sure to follow all of our respective podcasts on Twitter and to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcatching app. For real, go to iTunes right now, give us a 5-star rating, and leave us a review about how much you like us. Let's trick the algorithm into showing our content to more people. Okay, back to the show.
One thing we haven't really talked about, but we've kind of hinted at, I guess, are, like, what are the characteristics of a great person, right? What makes a great person great? And there's a couple of things that have sneaked in just, by implication or suggestion in the discussion, I guess, which are personal charisma, which is maybe understood better as an effect than a cause, basically structural position. Actually, in the Plekhanov essay, Madame Pompadour is like an interesting kind of example, because this is not someone who is operating from like an official position of leadership or who commands like great social forces or articulates the beliefs or positions of a mass movement or anything like that. She's great in history because of her personal relationship to the king. And it's an interesting kind of example to use, I think. And it relies entirely on, like, basically the personal network position of this, you know, of Madame Pompadour. And not, it doesn't refer to her charisma or her, like, popularity or leadership among social forces at all, but only on to, like, where she found herself in the sort of structure of social relations that allowed her to have a totally outsized influence on them. That's two ways of thinking about greatness, right?
Sure.
The charismatic version versus the, like, the kind where you could almost go unnoticed at the time. Like, and you would only be seen, as it were, in retrospect.
Sort of a Dick Cheney kind of figure?
Yeah, I guess so.
It's funny that you said Cheney, because I was thinking of Talleyrand.
Who was able to go from the, you know, Ancien Régime to the Republic to Napoleon, keeping his head the entire time.
And then to the...
while maintaining...
during the Restoration as well.
Yeah.
And had a very, like, huge influence on, like, foreign policy and, like... like budgetary policy, and, you know, like, we know about him now, but I don't think that the average French citizen, whether they were sans culotte or, like, soldier or whatever, really thought much about Talleyrand, you know, or even knew about him.
Old Talleyrand.
Yes.
So for the discussion as it bears on the question of the left, right, I think obviously the question for us is where's our charismatic figure?
Yeah. I mean, like, if you look at if you survey the wreckage of the last two decades, you know, like, I think that there was a moment where people had really hoped it was Alexis Tsipras in Greece, you know, who was certainly, like, a charismatic figure and certainly whose personal individual will did have a decisive impact on the course of Greece and Europe and the world, and it was all bad. and so there's not much left to sort of salvage from that experience other than just it's just a tragedy, and I guess you just sort of have
just
to acknowledge
it.
That's what we do, is not that. But it doesn't seem to be the case. It's funny because, like, in some ways we were talking about charisma actually, like, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is one of those sort of great figures who wasn't also not a particularly charismatic figure, just, like, represented an ethos in utter defiance of his lack of charisma, you know?
Yeah. It's like, it's as if he was, like, given charisma, by his fans, you know? And it's like, ultimately that's kind of what charisma is. It's always an effect of the crowd, and not of the man, so to speak.
Yeah. It's not like a quantifiable, like, substance that a person has. Is subjective. Like, what is charisma? It's whatever moves people, whatever appeals to people.
Right. That's how you can have Trump as a charismatic figure.
That's right.
Despite the fact that a good 50% at least of the population looks at him and is just like, what the fuck's happening here?
Yeah, and I think almost anybody in the population, if you made them endure, like, trying to have a conversation with Trump for 5 minutes, they would just get fucking bored.
Well, and
well, I mean, no one has a none of the of his inner circle have a positive thing to say about him, like, you know.
Well, it's similar to Jeremy Corbyn.
No one can stand him,
because if you just had 5 minute conversation with Jeremy Corbyn, he'd be talking to you about gardening and his favorite bread. And
that's true. But that's like
a lot
that's
of people would find that boring.
That's all charming.
He would get along with Britney.
Trump would just talk about, like, ratings, you know. It's just like,
yeah,
and who he banged in the 80s.
So that's true too. So we survey our landscape, and what we see is a dearth of charismatic leading figures for, like, let's say the movement, you know, in quotes or whatever. And there's a type of person on the left that's like, we don't need them, no gods, no masters, and that's you know, it might feel good. It's like a kind of a, you can draw a little bit of reserve from, like, leaning upon ourselves, you know, even though we don't have any leaders. But if you just, like, look at the state of things as they are, it does appear as though maybe a couple leaders would be really useful for the left at the moment, because we don't really have a whole lot going on, despite the fact that history compels us to act, and you see the action happening all over the place, right? Like, this is not to deny that there there's obviously like a latent creative energy in that exists in the masses. It exists in the popular consciousness. And it's not to deny that it expresses itself in explosive, sometimes very destructive ways. And that these two things to me are not in contradiction, the creative energy and the destructive impulse. But the thing that's missing is what channels it, that what directs it, or even just what gives it an expression that becomes comprehensible to anybody outside of the moment. You know, so if you're not a BLM person, like if you're not a BLM protester who was there when the violence was perpetrated against the crowd and then that sparks a riot, then, you know, maybe your interpretation of events is different because you weren't there. So all you see is on the news, you see the riot. And there is no spokesperson to get up in front of the camera and give the account that is credible, that weaves the narrative for the population, that allows for people to learn lessons, you know, in tandem with each other around the country. Like, unless you're there, you don't get it.
Like, there's the person that everyone is waiting to hear their take
exactly
on, you know.
That's what leadership is. That's what the great figure does. And we haven't got that. Not in any way that I see, anyways.
You know, you never really know who this person that's going to, like, step into a role that history has provided until they step into it. So,
right. Well, and I should also say that this is also not to say that there are no influential people and that there are no leaders, right? But that there are, we're not at a point in the historical moment where there is like a decisive leadership being exercised anywhere.
Yeah. I would say that what passes for leadership on the left, it's actually kind of disappointing and depressing. I mean, the people that a lot of the left would champion and would hold up are, you know,
chumps.
Well, I was going to give some specific examples, but that'll suffice.
Well, there are people serving, you know, so it's like the best examples that I can think of, outside of, I mean, so there are some like leaders, as you say, Jason. It's not that there aren't leaders or influential people, with their own, you know, their own spheres of influence. Part of the problem is that like there's nobody who articulates the various spheres in which like there's some kind of like institutional coherence.
Right.
And each of those is like an island, or like, you know, it's all this sort of, there's this kind of archipelago of like left or progressive or broadly speaking, you know, left-wing social forces that each maybe have their own sort of champions, but no one who sort of stitches it all together. But, you know, it's like there is like the squad. There's like AOC and Ilhan Omar. And to me, I don't see why they're not just, you know, basically potential Bernie Sanders people. Right. They're as soon as they like have had a couple of more like terms under their belt and they get into like contending for office at that level, I guess, if they decide to, what's really the difference between like an AOC or an Ilhan Omar and Bernie Sanders in terms of like what potential they represent for like stitching together an otherwise like inchoate left wing movement? And like serving as innocent, like basically a charismatic figurehead for it.
Well, they don't have the 40-year-long links to the labor movement, you know, which doesn't really exist in the way that it did 40 years ago.
How important were those for Sanders, though, is the question, right? For Sanders in 2016, right. How important is that?
You would know. I mean, you're the labor studies guy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I think by and large, like labor does not come through for Bernie Sanders. You know, there was the big sort of like signal event was, the Nevada primary this year, where the Las Vegas that big fucking local of like all the like casino and hotel workers like agitated against universal healthcare and like tried to like win its membership against the idea of Medicare for all and like basically went to the mat against Bernie. And the union leadership in that case, they just didn't win over their members. I mean, Bernie Sanders won the membership over the heads of the leaders of that local. And so it's like, you know, I think that is interesting as an observation about like the 2020 primaries. But otherwise I'm not sure Sanders' connections to the labor movement, paid off for him very much, just in that, like, you know, there would be locals and stuff who would go for him. And there were, you know, there was a kind of an internal revolt inside the American Federation of Teachers in 2016 when the national leadership went for Clinton without a like a full sort of like voter survey by the membership. And so there were all these like, you know, local rank and file efforts by AFT teachers to like make Randy Weingarten take back the endorsement and to make them run, you know, a vote. Which the rank and file believed would have produced a good result for Sanders. But it's like, he's getting that stuff. It doesn't strike me that he's getting that stuff as a result of his connections to the labor movement. He was getting it at, like, you know, those rank and file labor people were enthusiastic about Sanders for all the same reasons that like a college student was, or, you know, like a Starbucks worker was, and they weren't getting it from their organizations. They were just, you know, watching it on the TV and the internet like everybody else was.
So you mean like it was more comparable to, I mean, this is going to seem silly to a lot of people, I think, but like not a direct analogy, of course, but more comparable to an Hugo Chavez situation than even a Jeremy Corbyn situation, in the sense that like the institutional linkages just aren't there. It's just an exciting moment that captures people's imagination in that moment.
Yeah, I guess it seems that way. And it's like the institutional linkages in the labor movement were all linked in the wrong direction, for the most part. Yeah. Which I guess is true in Venezuela as well.
And so in that, I don't know what the answer is to like what keeps, you know, other sort of like more mid-tier popular sort of leftish political figures from at some point occupying the Sanders role. I'm not sure if I have an answer for that. My suspicion is that because of the way that the last 4 years played out, that that moment has passed, that there was a particular moment where we could have passed through the window that was open, and I think it's closed. I might end up being wrong, but my guess is that the way that class struggle plays out in this country now, as a result of having passed through and or on the other side of the biggest opportunity for, like, you know, a coherent leftward tide, you know, personified by, you know, by a political figure at the helm of something that looks fairly traditional and mainstream. My guess is that now what we come to is a moment which is much more chaotic and much more unpredictable. And I just think it's less likely that we see a new Sanders moment in 8 years or whatever. Like, the political landscape will be so much different and the economic terrain will be so much different, you know, as a result of the way that these things didn't play out.
Like, that the left populist moment seems to be over. And that's what Sanders represented, was a sort of left populism, you know, not like the workers' movement, not like, you know, anything like that, but just essentially what would amount to like a cross class appeal because of dissatisfaction with the status quo. And I would be very surprised if that window hadn't closed.
Yeah. I think what we're in for in the short term, I guess the medium term, the next few years, is either a resurgence of the center in the event of a Biden victory, especially a decisive Biden victory, and renewed energy on the part of the Democratic center and right wing. The Democratic right wing will probably at that point deepen its links with the sort of anti-Trump elements in the Republican Party who are like looking for the life rafts as the ship sinks.
The neocons. Yeah.
Or the other outcome is Trump wins. And I don't know if that represents a collapse, like a final collapse of the center, or if it continues to cling to life, and like, you know, the left in this country just has the weight of the dead hand of centrism on it yet further, into the future, with like these, people like the, you know, the Schumers and the Pelosi's who are like, almost ideologically committed to losing. That seems to be the immediate term prospects, in my view.
It makes me wonder what sorts of outstanding individuals the coming moment in history will produce. Like, where will they be found? Are they going to be like leaders of wildcat strikes? Are they going to be like it's not clear because there is no primary sort of site of resistance. You know, we
trained Marxists on the board of Antifa LLC.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's everybody who was on those planes. You
know? I'm broadcasting now from the Antifa plane. We're in the air just now, headed from Washington D.C. to Portland to send some more reinforcements to the troops.
Super soldiers.
Yeah,
yeah, like so. You know, great figures of not too distant American history are. You know, they seem to be inevitable. You know, your Malcolm X's and, you know, people that sort of seem inevitable because they emerge from like a moment where the social forces that are arrayed are clear to us in retrospect. I wonder how clearly they may have been, like, I wonder how easy they would have been to predict, you know, in their own time. Like, I don't know if we should take comfort in that we don't yet know, or if it actually, if it actually says something, you know, somewhat unique or specific about our own historical moment. Because obviously, like, well, I don't know if it's obvious, but the argument that I have sort of wanted to make here is that, there's great efficacy of will, that like human willpower and freedom are like real things, are real tangible things. But that also that like, you know, it is circumstances and events that compel people into these positions where they do or don't exercise their will. But they have to be created out of the struggle in some way. And it's at least for me presently impossible to imagine from whence they come. And I don't think it's because people like read a good magazine or a good book or listened to a podcast and got really smart. Like I just don't, that's not the place where, you know, great leaders are born.
Are you saying that you think that the will can triumph?
As a matter of fact, I think it could. Doesn't necessarily always mean that it should.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the way I've typically thought about, like, the question of leadership is that, like, leadership is a problem that organizations have to solve by being institutions that produce leaders.
Exist.
Yeah.
They have to exist.
That's a good that's a good first step.
Yeah. There is a, it's like, you know, it's kind of hard you know, there's a little bit of a chicken egg thing there where it's like, you need the institutions to produce the leaders, but without the leaders, it's really hard to build the institutions. But you know, it's like, we're, of course, like the MLKs and Malcolm X's were, they didn't like read a good book. They, were like trained in organizational life.
You're saying the Bible and the Quran aren't good books?
Okay, yeah,
you know, they're pretty good books.
Like loads of people read those and they don't all become great leaders.
The overwhelming majority of them don't.
Yeah. It's not like the Communist Manifesto or everyone who reads it becomes a great revolutionary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Capable of personifying their own true Marxism and leading their own tendency.
That's right. You know, those examples are interesting, like Malcolm X and MLK. I mean, one, it is impossible not to think of the moment that we're living in now, at this sort of phase of like the Black Lives Matter movement and the sort of the phase of the broader like Black freedom struggle. And one characteristic of this moment is that there, you know, as far as I know, you know, that that movement, which has been like a fount of an incredible amount of energy. And, you know, since 2014 has been responsible for the most massive and, you know, vital mobilizations in American life, hasn't really thrown forward leaders of that sort. I don't mean for this to be – every time there's a riot, there's like a white guy that asks like where's like the Martin Luther King of today, by which they mean like why isn't anyone like making people not be violent? The more interesting question about like why is there no MLK today is like why – how is it that you have this like extraordinary – I mean like really historic proportions of mobilizations with really broad social forces taking part really quite unprecedented in a lot of ways in American life. And it's not throwing forward anyone to stitch it all together.
Right. Well, and you know, we could pick a different political figure to just like
Thomas Sankara.
Yeah. Where's our Thomas Sankara? I was going to say our, you know, Huey Newton.
Right. That's right.
Where's our Kathleen Cleaver? Like, where are the, I mean, hell, even, well, we don't really want, like, the weather people back, right? But just, like, where are these people who are trying to embody history? And I guess the question is this part of the psychological baggage of growing up in the end of history, where we just really have a, again, however we conceptualize ourselves at a more subconscious ideological level, not at a political level, do we actually not really think of history? Like, you know, is the problem that we as a generation don't actually have a vision of the future? We only have a resistance mentality. Like, this is a thing I don't like. I don't want it. But like, there's no constructive, you know, utopian vision of the horizon, like the place to arrive and to struggle toward, the summit to climb.
Yeah, our visions are of the end of the world.